A photo of Iola and Isabel taken standing by a miniature hippopotamus at the 1940 World's Fair. Along the frame at the bottom, the text read, Billy the Famous Pygmy Hippo, once owned by President Coolidge. The story floated through the mist, a scrap of words. Iola spoke to me as I slept, her voice that of a 17-year-old girl slowly discovering the world outside the island and the orphan school through travels with Isabel. And such wonder all around us. There are no words for these many amazing things. I sat with Isabel in moving chairs at the General Motors Pavilion as we slowly circled Futurama, a tiny vision of what is to come. The world of 1960 will be beautiful. Communities carefully arranged for commerce, fine living, and ease of transportation. The tiny buildings in the city of the future are sleek and wide, joined by grand roads that run like ribbons from here to there. The transfer points fanning out in spirals like the leaves on a summer clover. Atop the city buildings, landing pads await auto gyros and helicopters. I try to imagine such a place as this one, people sailing the air like a sea. Look at the roads, Isabel gasps. One day we'll climb into an auto and travel all the way to California without stopping. She squeezes my hand, her eyes wide as we pass by a circular airport where a tiny dirigible waits at a hangar. Imagine it, Iola. All of us driving autos wherever we wish to go, even the women. A car for every house. When Isabel comes home to the island, she pleads with old Rupert to let her drive the car. We won't need a ferry. We'll ride a dirigible to the island and be there in the blink of an eye. I lean close and whisper, even the colors, do you think? In my mind, I hear my mom hiss, keep them bright eyes down, Miss Hightone. You might talk like them convent sisters, but you still a color girl. Shaolan, Isabel's lashes flash wide. We both know that I've been passing on this trip. People see two college girls, Isabel in her sweater and me alongside. No one is the wiser, but neither Isabel nor I've spoken of it. Maman sent me along to watch after her, and back home, Maman and Mamma T and old Rupert are fretting of a storm that will make it back safe before Monsieur comes to Benoit House. With Madame dead and buried, he has no place else to be. I fall quiet in my seat as we circle round and around that miniature city of the future. I wonder, Father, in that future city, is there a tiny colored girl who no longer keeps her eyes down? Stand up straight, Iola Ann, Isabel says as we stroll along afterward, past the pavilions of Poland and Czechoslovakia, which have not reopened this year due to the war in Europe. Isabel looks the other way, hooks her arm in mine, and passes by a woman handing out leaflets about knitting sweaters for the British soldiers. It's bad enough we have to hear of it in the papers over and over again, she complains. If it weren't for the war, I could finish my art education in France this last term, but who knows when I'll ever go anywhere once Papa comes home. I'll never learn to drive an auto now. You will. In 1960, everyone will have them, I say to cheer her. Just think of all those roads. We laugh and go along, playing our game of let's pretend together. We are two college girls, cousins, out to the fair. No one notices, but I wonder, Father, are you angry with me? Sister Mary Constantine taught the sins of omission long ago. I have become an omission. At a dance for European war relief, a blonde-haired soldier boy purchases a paper rose and asks if I might dance with him. Isabel whispers in my ear, don't say anything, just go. Pushing me away, her face as buoyant as her tumble of strawberry curls. Go dance. A soldier boy will leave soon to join the war effort. His parents are French, his grandparents engaged in the struggle against terrible forces. When the first dance is over, he smiles and whispers, such a beautiful face. He asks if he may write to me. I tell him that my mother would never approve of it. Then we have tonight to dance, he says, and my mind swirls and my feet are winged. Never have I lived a moment like this one. There is no anathema tonight.
I dreamed of Iola dancing with her soldier, their images floating feather-light against the sky. Around them, a world running headlong from the horse and buggy era toward a society of family cars, commercial airlines, and cross-country interstates. Everything was changing, and as Isabel's world opened, Iola's was opening as well. But she was playing a dangerous game. There were laws governing such things. Guilt followed Iola on the train home the next day, the newly acquired weight growing heavier and heavier as the train steamed south.
I know the wickedness of temptation, its sly and clever ways, the sweet taste of what is forbidden. I think to myself, what would Sister Mary Constantine say? I know I must never do this thing again. I know I must not write letters to this soldier boy, pretending to be what I am not. No good could come of it. But still, I wonder, could he love me if he knew? Forgive me, Father. Forgive my weakness. Forgive my wandering. Bring me to those beautiful shores of home, and let me content my feet in the soft sands of all that you have prepared for me. Let me be thankful for all that you have given, neither hungering nor thirsting for what is not my cup. Your loving daughter, Iola Ann.
The dim awareness of waking pulled me from the dream of Iola's letters. I felt the kiss of hot tears on my skin, draining into my hair. I wanted to take that young girl's hands in mine and say, don't listen. Don't let them tell you who you are. You are just as worthy as Isabel. I blinked and blinked again, my eyes grainy and rough from sneaking away again to spend time in the boxes. Between working at Sandy's, cleaning at Iola's, and reading the letters at night, I was running on fumes. But things were finally taking shape. Satisfaction rested like a cool, soft sheet over me as I lay in my bed. The kitchen at Iola's house looked so much better. I'd stored all the newspapers in a closet under the stairs. So far, I'd managed the work at Sandy's. The old beadboard wainscoting had dried out nicely and gone back together more easily than I'd thought it would. The repairs on the drywall were progressing now. Even things at home had settled down. Rowdy and Zoe were definitely history. She didn't want to talk about it, but she was acting more like herself, looking after her little brother, spending long hours in the back room with him, playing video games and helping him with his homework. Paul had stopped by to finish the weed eating, and he and JT had cooked a hot dog supper on the old stone grill behind the cottage. It was nice to have a friend who was just a friend, not a guy looking to get something out of it. JT liked him. They walked around the yard together, talked about arthropods and gastropods and other scientific things. With a few leads on future handywoman work already coming in, sea turtle camp this summer seemed like a possibility. Mama. The sound startled me, sitting me upright. Zoe's voice. Zoe? I whispered, throwing the covers aside and standing. The floor was salty, damp, and cool, as if someone had left the windows open last night.
Mama?
She whimpered again. I wondered if she might be dreaming. The voice had her little girl sound to it, needy, sweet, afraid to make too many demands on anyone. In the small room next to mine, she was lying atop her bed, fully clothed in jeans and a tank top, but curled into herself, her arms wrapped around her long, thin legs, her bare feet tucked tight. At first glance, it was obvious that something was very wrong. The window was open, the air cold. Her hair wasn't just damp, but wet around her head. I touched the sheet, found it warm and wet despite the cool air. Zoe. Her skin was fiery hot beneath my fingers. What happened? Where have you been?
Nowhere, she moaned. I was, gonna go a party. Rowdy at the beach, but I didn't feel good. Oh, my body hurts, Mama.
Zoe, you're burning up. A hint of frustration came out in the words, and I hoped she couldn't hear it. Worries were racing already. We can't afford a doctor visit. I can't stay home today. How would we even go to a doctor? We don't have any insurance. I had no idea how much a visit might cost these days. For 6 years, Trammell had taken care of us, prescribing everything we needed.
Sorry.
Zoe sobbed miserably. Burying her face in the pillow, she tried to push my hand away. When did you start feeling bad? Why didn't you tell me sooner? I smoothed the tangle of hair away from her lips. Why in the world were you trying to sneak out in the middle of the night to go to a party when you're sick? Please tell me you weren't chasing after Rowdy again.
I wanted to go see.
She rose from the pillow and tried to reach for her cell phone on the night table. I'd never seen it before.
I gotta go.
I pushed her shoulders gently back, then picked up the phone. The case looked new. I could only assume that Rowdy had bought it for her during one of their shopping sprees before they broke up. Don't worry about him. Are you hurting anywhere else? Or are you sick to your stomach? We went through a list of symptoms. It sounded like the flu. I gave her ibuprofen and waited, hoping she would sleep, hoping the fever would break. By 6 o'clock in the morning, she was worse. I ran a bath to cool her down and helped her into the tub, then paced the house trying to decide what to do next. What if it was really something serious? What if it was more than just the flu? I didn't have the money for a doctor visit, much less an emergency room call. Would they even see Zoe if I couldn't pay for it on the spot? Sandy would help if I called her, but she had no idea what a shambles my life was in. Neither did any of the seashell shop women. If they knew, I would be a hard luck story, a charity case. I wanted respect. I wanted to earn my own way. I wanted to build a life I could be proud of, one I could live in front of my kids without setting all the wrong examples. It was finally happening. And now this. Zoe called for me, and I found her halfway out of the bathtub, dripping, shivering, clinging to the shower door. There was a faint rash on her stomach and back, the skin raw and red as she cowered in the towel, too exhausted to argue about my helping her into clean clothes. She leaned on me, her head resting on my shoulder as I helped her into bed.
"I think I feel better,"
she chattered out, but her skin sizzled against mine. "I don't need a doctor, okay? Can I have some more Motrin yet? My body hurts." JT passed by in the hall, moving in a sleepy stupor as he cast a concerned look our way.
"What's wrong with Zoe?"
"She's sick. You stay out of here, all right?" I crossed the room and stopped him at the door. Hopefully, whatever it was, he hadn't caught it and wouldn't. "Are you okay? You don't feel sick or hot or anything?"
"Uh-uh."
He folded his arms behind his back, his collarbones poking out against the neck of his T-shirt.
"She wasn't sick last night when she was in my room."
"When you two were playing Zega Wars, you mean?" "I think it started after that, sometime during the night." There was no point in telling JT that his sister had apparently been on her way out the window to chase after a boy who dumped her once already. His lip curled, compacting the freckles on his nose.
"Zoe doesn't play Zega Wars."
He rolled his eyes as if I should surely know better than to have made that assumption.
"She emails people."
He whispered the words, flicking a worried look that told me he'd been threatened with his life if he told.
"Who's she emailing? I didn't know you could email on that thing."
Not that it would have mattered, even if I'd known. I probably would have been afraid to check my old account to see if there were any messages from the reporter I'd sent Trammell's secret records to. I couldn't get over the feeling that any form of contact with my old life could lead Trammell to us. JT turtled his neck between his shoulders.
"Shh."
We moved to the kitchen, and he folded his bare legs into a chair. "Okay, now spill. Who's Zoe been emailing? Do you know where she was headed last night? Who has she been talking to online?" I thought the story about Rowdy and a beach party hadn't made sense. Who had she been planning to meet?
She doesn't tell.
JT was hedging. He always rolled his eyes upward and looked at the ceiling when he was pulling a story out of the air. "You'd better tell me the truth, and you better tell me now." I leaned close, made him look at me. "JT, if you know anything about who your sister has been talking to or why, I need to know."
"She wouldn't tell me who. I tried to see the password, but she told me to quit snooping on her. She texted Rowdy last night. I looked at it when she was in the bathroom. He was mad at her because she wouldn't give the cell phone back. She told him she was going on a road trip and she needed it."
"A road trip?" This got stranger by the minute, and more frightening. How did all the pieces fit together? What did they add up to? There was only one person who knew for sure. I left JT at the table and ran back to Zoe's room. "Zoe, I want to know what's going on with you, all of it." I leaned closer, touched her cheek, felt the heat of her breath on my fingers, but Zoe wouldn't answer. Chapter 19.
West Nile virus? How did she... how serious is...
The words were scrambled in my head. The emergency room doctor pressed the clipboard to his chest, leaned forward sympathetically, and pulled the door closed, the sound echoing down the corridor where we'd been waiting for news. Paul touched my arm, steadying me. Cords of muscle contracted, then relaxed inside the torn-off sleeve of a sweatshirt he must have thrown on after my frantic call this morning. When Zoe wouldn't wake up, he was the first person I thought of. West Nile virus. The idea exploded inside my head, setting off a flash fire. West Nile was in the news every summer in Texas. When horses contracted it, the virus could be fatal. Cities sent out spray trucks with vats of insecticide to kill mosquito larvae in roadside ditches. Last year, the outbreak was so epidemic, there had been aerial spraying in Dallas.
It's carried by mosquitoes and contracted through a bite.
The doctor was calm, clinical.
There's no history of direct human-to-human transmission, so there isn't any reason to worry that family members or friends could have caught it from her. Mr. Chastain mentioned that your son went on to school today. There's no need to keep him home, as long as he's showing no symptoms.
I tried to catch my breath. Surely the doctor would be more concerned than this if it were really serious. Surely they'd be rushing around, giving her IVs, antibiotics, something. I took a step toward the door. I wanted to see her. I needed to touch her, to lay my head against hers and tell her everything would be all right.
Typically, human cases of West Nile are subclinical, but about 20% of the people infected will show mild to severe flu-like symptoms. Most often, those pass within a day or two, although on occasion the symptoms can linger. The real concern when WNV does produce a febrile illness, such as in Zoe's case, is the secondary development of meningitis, encephalitis, or both. Fortunately, her case has been caught early. We've brought the fever down, and there's some newer research that indicates the use of antivirals, so we're going to start those with Zoe, just to be cautious. As with other viral illnesses, such as shingles, there can be a risk of flaccid paralysis, so it's important to make sure her treatment is continued at home and that she continues with her medications even after she feels better. The teenagers sometimes think they're fully healed before they really are. Keep an eye on her. Make sure she doesn't try to do too much for a while. No school, no working, no running around with friends.
Paul sighed, his shoulders sagging with relief. Home? Had I heard that correctly? And just a couple of hours ago, Paul was lifting Zoe's limp body from the perspiration-soaked sheets and carrying her to the SUV as she moaned on his shoulder. Was the doctor trying to shuffle us out of here because, by now, he knew we couldn't pay? We'd barely gotten in the hospital door before a woman with a clipboard had whisked me into an office to fill out forms. While Paul sat in the waiting room with my baby girl, I'd been forced to explain that I had no insurance and no money. Are you sure it's okay for her to go home? She doesn't need to stay in the hospital?
We'll keep her for observation for the day, but at this point, I don't think we'll have to admit her overnight. As long as there's someone home with her the next few days, monitoring her temperature, making sure she takes in plenty of fluids and doesn't exert herself, things should be fine. She'll recover more quickly at home where she's comfortable, and at home, there's less risk of her being exposed to any secondary pathogens while her immune system is compromised by WNV. It's really the best thing. Just don't leave her by herself.
Okay. I stammered, still trying to process everything as the doctor walked away. Paul tucked his hands in the pockets of his bleach-spotted camp pants and smiled, his eyes gentle and kind, tender. A rush of emotions filled me, and a mist clouded the image of Paul, standing there with his crooked, freckled grin. "She's going to be okay," I breathed.
"She's going to be okay," he repeated. "Was there ever any doubt? She comes from tough stock."
Our gazes caught, and a hot flush replaced the coolness of the corridor. I purposely didn't analyze the meaning of it, but stepped away instead, felt the heat in my cheeks as I watched the doctor disappear through another doorway. "Thanks, Paul." There was a lump in my throat. I didn't know who to call. Ross is out of town, and when she was so sick, I couldn't think of what to do. I just panicked. If you hadn't answered the phone, I don't know.
"It's okay."
Without the ever-present fishing hat, his red hair fell in tangled strands over his forehead, curling slightly at the ends as he looked at me.
"You would have handled the situation, Tandy, but I'm glad you called. It's not a problem."
"You're a good friend." It seemed important to say the word out loud for both of us. Friend. The relationship needed a label, a category. What did you call the person who dropped everything and came running to save your life? Paul had been so cool, so logical through this whole thing. He knew his way around the rigmarole of hospitals and medical forms. The reason hadn't occurred to me until now. Did being here among the clinical sights and smells bring back memories of his wife's illness, or her death? I was a basket case. It was embarrassing now, thinking about how I'd babbled and sobbed out half of my life story. No medical insurance, no money, no family I could ask. It was a testament to Paul's character that he was still here. He'd even taken the morning off school so that he could stay with us. I'd heard the secretary joking on the phone that he'd ruined his perfect attendance record for the year.
You love your daughter.
He leaned across the space between us, his fingers still tucked in his pockets.
Don't worry about it, okay? But if you really are worried about it and you really feel the need to pay me back for all this trouble, you could make me some of those banana beignets.
He lifted both shoulders.
I'm just saying, if that would lessen the guilt in any way, I will be happy to do my part and eat said beignets.
Then we were laughing again, and the strangest realization slipped by, stealthy and quick, like the breeze sliding around the leeward edge of a dune. I loved the way Paul made me laugh. I am so going to make you beignets, as Sniffle chuckled, and we moved to the chairs to wait for someone to tell us we could see Zoe. Ideas circled in my head as time ticked by, news of Zoe coming a bit at a time. Beignets in cute baskets, an assortment of beignets made with different fruits, chocolate beignets, beignets with homemade whipped cream like Meemaw used to serve. Beignets in a fishing basket, beignets shaped like fish. I could surprise Paul at school with beignets for the whole class. The parade of inspirations was a good distraction from the question of hospital bills and how I could possibly stay home with Zoe for several days. I had to work, and in fact, I needed to be at work today. But there was still the question of who Zoe had been emailing and why she was planning to sneak out the window in the middle of the night. What if she tried to run off again? What if whoever she was talking to came by the cottage?
You're quiet,
Paul said as we sat in the hospital cafeteria eating lukewarm sandwiches that he had insisted on paying for. I glanced at the clock above the food service counter. Sorry, I'm just trying to think things through. I guess I should call Sandy and let her know that I can't come today. Paul handed me his phone. I took it and rubbed my thumb back and forth across the screen. This'll leave Sandy in such a bind. She has the building inspector coming on Monday. If the place isn't ready, it's like a month before she can get him out there again. The music festival starts Wednesday. She's counting on being open by then. Maybe I could leave JT home to help Zoe. If I called from the shop every hour to see that they were okay, made sure she took her medicine on time. Paul was already stretching across the table, reaching for the phone.
You know what? Let me call the school and...
No, Paul. The words were quick and sharp, stopping him halfway out of his chair. He hovered there, his brows peeking under tangles of hair. I closed my eyes, tried to gather my thoughts. You've already done enough. You can't take more time off work for us. Watch out, the voice in my head was whispering. When people give something, they want something back. What is he after? What does he want? The voice surprised me, although it shouldn't have. I'd understood that push-pull all my life. I'd lived by it, learned the lesson over and over and over again. When people showed unusual interest, teachers, neighbors, other kids' parents, foster parents, they wanted to get close to you for some reason, and those reasons usually led to pain. Those people wanted you, or they wanted your secrets. Either way, you were safer on your own.
I don't mind.
Paul's eyes were so earnest, the welcoming brown of damp earth. I could sink my feet in, fall right into him. But this, exactly this, was how I'd gotten in such a mess with Trammell. A crisis, a desperate moment, a slow building of dependence. After the accident, Trammell had been so kind, so helpful and generous, I couldn't say no. I felt the hardness around my body like an extra layer of skin. Iola had softened it. She'd eased it with her letters. She'd whittled away at it with donated Tiffany lamps and shrimp boats washed ashore and $50 bills and envelopes for the grocery boy. And look what happened to her. Look how things turned out. A crazy lady locked in her house. Dead, and not one of those people cared. She could have bought anything she wanted with the money from that lamp. Then there was Paul, slowly settling back into his chair across from me, a crease forming between his brows as he tried to bore through my forehead and get at my thoughts. I just need to do this myself. What else was there to say, really? It was the truth. Before I could lose my nerve, I dialed the number for Sandy's shop. She answered on the first ring, and I stumbled through an explanation. I hadn't even finished, and she was trying to shut me down.
Wait, now just a minute.
My stomach started churning, the taste of roast beef on rye bubbling up. She was upset with me, of course. I couldn't blame her.
Listen, I know what a mess this will put you in. I'm so sorry, but I just... Zoe can't be home by herself right now.
Across the table, Paul was once again trying to offer himself up, in sign language this time. I pretended to be focused on the phone conversation.
Okay, now listen.
Sandy's voice was flat, determined. I prepared myself to face that side of her I'd only heard about, the one that was reserved for building inspectors, teenagers showing too much PDA on the boardwalk, and rowdy drunks who wandered in off the beach.
There are two of us here, and with you, that makes three. The rest of us can't finish the drywall, but we sure can look after a sick little girl, so I'll tell you how this is going to work. The minute they let Zoe out of there, you call me. Sharon or I, or maybe even Teresa and Cassie, will be at your house by the time you get there, with chicken soup in hand. I'll even make the chicken soup from scratch. I'll run out and pick up the stuff right now. I've been home with sick kids more than you can count. What time do you think we'll need to be there?
Color prickled into my cheeks and emotion choked my throat. Why so much more kindness than I really deserved? They made me wish that I were a better person, that I weren't hiding so much about myself. I can't ask you to do that, Sandy.
Across the table, Paul rolled his eyes and threw his palms up. You're not asking. I'm telling. Right now, I wouldn't care if you were the Octomom, if you'd have my wall ready by Monday. I'd watch after 8 sick babies. I'm a grandma. I know how to do these things. You don't argue with a grandma when she's got her mind made up. You won't win.
No, I guess not. I laughed and sniffled. This day was breaking me down and building me up in so many ways that I didn't recognize my own shape anymore. Thank you, Sandy. I don't know how to...
There's no need. You're in the sisterhood of the seashell shop now. We shell shop girls look after each other. That's how it works. What God puts together, no building inspector, nor nasty virus, nor Category 2 hurricane can tear apart. It's like being married, only without the hanky-panky. Once you're ours forever.
I couldn't even answer. I just nodded as Sandy went on.
You call me the minute you know anything. I'm headed out for chicken and celery.
She gave me her mobile number. Paul slid a pen from his shirt pocket and wrote it on a napkin as I repeated it. There was a knowing look in his eyes when he handed me the napkin. His lips pulled sideways into a self-satisfied smirk.
See?
His smirk added, you should have listened to me in the first place. The strangest feeling came over me when we were finally notified that we could go upstairs to see Zoe. It was like the light from my dream, a fully enveloping warmth that surrounded my body from outside, but came from inside me as well. I'd never known anything like it. As we stood in the elevator, I closed my eyes, let my head fall against the wall, felt it around me and through me. For a moment, there seemed to be nothing in the world to fear, nothing more powerful than this. The door chimed. I opened my eyes, and the spell was broken. Tension crackled through me like an electrical current as I left Paul outside the room of curtained beds and followed a nurse back to the one that was hiding Zoe. She opened her eyes drowsily at the sound of my voice.
Mama?
A whisper was all she could manage. She looked so pale and drained, her skin ashen alongside her dark hair, her eyes luminously blue against the pallor.
Ah, sweetheart, I said and kissed her. How are you feeling? What happened?
She murmured, seeming confused by the curtain, the stainless steel trays, the tubes and monitors sitting idle in the corners.
You've got a virus. You were really sick last night.
She didn't remember any of it, I guessed. Maybe that was just as well.
Did I go to Aunt Gina's?
She pushed an arm against the mattress, trying to lift herself.
Shh, lie still, okay?
Aunt Gina's? What in the world? I hadn't heard from Gina in months. 6 weeks after Trammell threw her off his place, she blew through town with a car full of cosmetic samples and wanted to pick up the clothes she'd left behind. Somehow she'd landed a job selling makeup to drugstores. Gina had always been tall, willowy, beautiful like her mother. And, like Mama, she knew exactly how to use it.
Are we in Texas?
Zoe's hair bunched against the pillow as she looked for clues in the room. A picture began sketching itself in my mind, the lines slowly filling in. Zoe had been trying to run away, and it had something to do with my sister. All that secret emailing had been about making plans.
Were you trying to go back to Dallas? Is that what's been going on?
She turned her face away, closed her eyes, and tried to lose herself in the pillow. She was so tired, so weak, but I needed to know what she'd gotten herself into. Zoe, were you trying to run away?
Tears seeped beneath her lashes, and I was sorry I'd asked.
Why do you care?
Zoe, of course I care.
Suddenly her illness was a blessing, the virus like an instrument of salvation. Instead of lying in a hospital bed, she could be anywhere right now. How in the world did she plan to get all the way back to Texas?
Did Aunt Gina have anything to do with this?
Even exhausted, her face revealed the truth.
Chapter 20. On Monday, when I stepped out the door to leave for the shell shop, Geneva Bank, of all people, was pulling into the cottage driveway in the little golf cart she kept next to the grocery store. She held up a casserole dish covered in a gingham napkin, smiling over the top of it as she exited the golf cart. "I was just making out a famous crunchy sausage and crab balls for the ladies' lunch at church tomorrow. I thought I'd bring a plate over," she said, as if it were the most natural thing in the world for her to be showing up on my doorstep. Zoe bumped into me from behind, surprised when I stopped in the doorway. I'd made the command decision to take Zoe to work with me instead of leaving her home alone. The grandmothering from the shell shop girls had worked wonders in the last few days. Zoe was better physically, but not at all enthusiastic about returning to school sometime in the near future. With Rowdy and his crowd ignoring her, she felt hopeless and lonely. And there wasn't much the shell shop sisters or I could do to help that issue. Zoe threaded her way around me as Geneva came up the steps, holding the gingham napkin in place with her thumbs as the wind toyed with it.
"Well, my goodness, look at you," Geneva twittered when she saw Zoe. "Glad you're up and around. I hope that brother of yours hasn't been stuffing you too full of donuts these last couple days."
With Zoe sick and me working like a banshee to piece Sandy's shop back together for inspection, JT had been hanging around at Bink's store more than ever. He'd been coming home with little baskets of goodies packed by Geneva in addition to the leftover donuts.
"Thanks for the cookies and stuff."
Zoe's voice was lifeless and flat. Recovering or not, she still had misery written all over her.
"Well, sure. It's my pleasure."
Geneva balanced the dish in one hand and touched Zoe's arm as she passed.
"You just feel better, all right? That brother of yours has been worried about you."
Zoe forced a sad, tired smile and went on to the car. Geneva and I stood in awkward silence, the scent of crab balls wafting up. "Those smell really good," I said finally, thinking I would take the dish to the shell shop. We'd all be working like crazy, getting everything in place for the inspection today, and hopefully an opening before the music festival started. I'd finished the second coat of paint on the wall last night, while Teresa and Cassie sat at the house with Zoe, and Paul took JT night fishing.
"One of my specialties."
Geneva reached across the space between us and helped me capture the fluttering napkin. Her hand lingered there a moment.
"I'm sorry we haven't been better neighbors. We're usually a friendly bunch here in Fairhope. But it's always been a strange situation, with Iola in the house. I'm sorry you got caught in the middle of it. It has nothing to do with you and your precious kids. We're glad to have you here. We don't get new families all that often."
"It has nothing to do with you." The muscles in my neck stiffened. "What exactly did I get caught in the middle of? I've wondered." Geneva's lips pursed, her gaze flicking away.
"Well, I never really understood all of it myself, not being from Fairhope. Bink and I didn't move back here until his parents gave up the store and retired about 10 years ago. I mean, I'd heard a little chatter over the years when we visited. It's hard to come to Fairhope and not wonder about this big house. The whole patch of woods back there is part of the estate. It runs right behind our cottage. I'd heard Iola Ann Poole's name muttered around, but folks don't like to talk about it. But they haven't forgotten, either."
Geneva's gaze darted nervously toward the big white house. Then she leaned close and whispered,
"She stole this place when old Mr. Benoit died. His mind wasn't good, and she took advantage of it. At least that's how the story goes. I try not to tell things as true if I wasn't there, and I wasn't. But Gerard Benoit's family members expected to inherit the estate, and there was an agreement to sell it to a group of local folks and repurpose it for a resort, sort of the bygone era of shipping tycoons, the grace and grandeur of Titanic and all that kind of thing. They'd already put quite a bit into forming the corporation and having all the legal work done. Almost everyone in Fairhope had money invested, and these weren't rich people.
Then, next thing they knew, old Mr. Benoit died, and it all belonged to Iola, not the rightful heirs, his nephews. She wouldn't hear of selling it.
Folks feel like she took advantage of the old man when he was bedridden and out of his mind, maybe threatened him with that nonsense about a voodoo curse and who knows what else. It set a lot of people back financially, and of course it kept all the new tourist business from coming to Fairhope.
Glancing toward the house again, she held her hands up at her sides.
Like I said, I don't know what's true, and Matthew 12 says that the things that come out of the mouth come from the heart, and that's not the kind of heart I want to have. I wish I'd tried harder to be a neighbor to Iola in the 10 years we've been here. But it always started trouble with Bank, and to tell you the truth, I hated to see her just letting this house go downhill. She couldn't take care of the place, but she wouldn't turn loose of it.
She loved this place, I said quietly, thinking of her letters.
You have brought me one step short of heaven.
People have no idea how much she loved the island. She'd been here most of her life. But Geneva was right. By clinging to the house, she'd come close to destroying it.
I know the church has some hope of taking over ownership of it, but I'm afraid that's not what's going to happen. Geneva sighed. Bain keeps an ear to the ground, and he's heard that the county commission is bound and determined to have this property for an eventual stormwater management site. Since the hurricane, they've gotten a lot of pressure and support from high-dollar homeowners farther up the island, who are tired of their houses sitting in water every time a rain comes along. Bink believes that they'll make Fairhope into one big holding pond if they can. It's David and Goliath, and I hate to say it, but we're David.
The only slingshot that's kept this thing at bay was the fact the Benoit house was a historic landmark, and thanks to Iola, that may be ruined.
If the house isn't viable, there is no landmark. Of course people are mad. Anyway, you asked, and that's the story as I know it. I'd better get back to the store.
I said goodbye to Geneva with a singular, terrible image in my mind. The little village of Fairhope, Iola's grand old house, and the ancient maritime forest behind it, reduced to a holding pond. In the car, Zoe was slumped in her seat, her head resting against the window, her face a picture of unhappiness.
You didn't have to bring me with you. I'm not going to run away. I don't have any place to go anyway.
She'd refused to explain how she'd planned to get back to Texas, other than that she'd hoped to pawn the phone Rowdy had bought her and return some of the clothes that still had tags on. She thought that would be enough to buy a bus ticket. Her problems inched into my mind, elbowing out Iola in her house. I wanted to make everything better for my little girl, take away all the pain, but nothing seemed to help. No matter how many times I told her that Rowdy wasn't worth all this heartbreak, and no matter how kind Sandy and the Shell Shop girls were to her, Zoe couldn't seem to break out of the gloom.
I didn't decide to bring you along because I don't trust you, Zoe. I just thought it might be a nice day for you. Different scenery, you know? If you feel like it, you can help Sandy with displays or something in the shop. And if you don't feel like doing anything, there are plenty of sofas and books and a couple computers with internet service in the coffee bar. I instantly wished I hadn't brought that up. I didn't want her to think of contacting Gina. I'd hidden JT's game box in Iola's house. The strange thing was that JT didn't seem to mind. He was more interested in hanging out at Banks or with Brother Gilbo or going fishing with Paul. Where his skin had always been sallow and pale, now he was ruddy and sun-kissed, an island boy with freckles under a tan, his hair bleaching to a soft gold on the ends. Brother Gilbo had brought him a fishing hat so his nose wouldn't burn anymore. I wish things were going so well for Zoe.
Not like that'll do me any good,
she sighed.
Aunt Gina never even answered me when I told her I was coming down there. I guess she didn't really mean it about the extra room I could stay in.
The truck bounced over a chuck hole, and her head rattled against the window. She didn't seem to care.
Zoe, you never know what Aunt Gina means. She just says the things she thinks people want to hear, whatever's easy at the moment. Maybe she means it when she says it, I don't know. But she never should have told you anything like that. If I had the first idea where to find my sister, I'd snatch every hair from her pretty blonde head.
Yeah.
Zoe crumpled against the door again, watching without interest as hedges, hotels, and beach homes drifted by. She barely bothered to look when I pointed to the roof of Sandy's seashell shop ahead on the right. As the place came fully into view, she sat up slightly, taking in the bright yellow exterior, the colorful chairs and tables on the deck outside. Pretty neat, huh? A sense of pride warmed me. I felt like a piece of Sandy's seashell shop was mine. My own little ocean of possibilities. Zoe craned forward. Yeah. She had a little more enthusiasm now. Once we were inside, hopefully Sandy, Sharon, and all their treasures would help. The seashell shop was like Iola's house. It had a magic all its own. Inside, Sandy was already red-faced and sweating. She was bustling around the shop, pressing the end of a pen against different areas of the drywall. Before we painted yesterday, I'd fixed old termite-eaten areas we'd discovered in several other places, including a couple in the ceiling. The patches weren't perfect, but they were close. There wasn't any way the building inspector would find them. "I'm just making sure," Sandy said without stopping to look at us as I carried the dish of crab balls to the coffee counter. "When that nasty inspector gets here, there is not going to be one thing he can find to fail us." She lifted the pen into the air, posing momentarily, her short blonde hair falling in sweaty strings over her forehead. "As God is my witness, we shall never be red-tagged again." Zoe gave me the sideways fisheye, as in, "Is this what you people do around here?" "No, we won't." I pumped a fist in agreement. I'd gotten used to Sandy's rabid enthusiasm. The woman was part pit bull, part Energizer bunny, and part tent preacher. For her, nothing was beyond the realm of prayer and possibility. "The youth music festival starts this week," she reminded, then she noticed Zoe trailing behind me. "Oh, hey, Zoe, you look like you're a whole sight better today. That's good. You can sort jewelry for me and put together some build-your-own-beach kits. I want to have plenty in stock in the glass globes and also the little ones in the clamshells. Tourists love those for take-home gifts. No time to loll around. We've got to be up and running, fully stocked, and back in the swing before the first day of the festival. George is going to stop by Sam's Club on his way home from the airport to pick up supplies for the coffee bar. If we don't pass inspection and get the place open, all will be lost, and the food George brings home will go to rot, but no pressure or anything. Help me check these walls one more time, just to make sure. Not that I don't trust you, but you don't know what the new inspector's like. Not you, Zoe. You get those crates off the counter and sort out the jewelry for the pegboards, and then get to work on some BYOB kits. Ask Sharon to show you the stuff, and you can pick out what to put in each one. It's all in a big jumble back there. We just threw it in boxes last fall. Don't work too much. You should be resting, but get the jewelry sorted and the kits made, okay?" Sandy paused for a breath, and Zoe looked at me, blinking wide. "Welcome to the Sisterhood of the Seashell Shop," I laughed, then slipped behind the counter for my putty knife. I wouldn't need it, I knew. These walls were right as rain. I'd been over every single solitary inch. We were checking the walls, and Zoe was sorting jewelry when the phone rang on the coffee counter. Sandy answered, then handed it to me. "It's Lover Boy." Ross had called me at the shop yesterday. He was sitting at a hotel, bored, and stuck somewhere in Mississippi, waiting for repairs on the lumber truck. I'd yakked as long as I thought I could get away with, holding the phone to my ear and commiserating while Ross ranted about his father being too cheap to buy new trucks. He was going to miss an amateur surf competition after he'd already paid the entry fee. "Sorry," I mouthed as I reached for the phone. Sandy clearly wasn't in the mood for distractions today. I let Ross spill the latest in the saga of the broken truck for a minute, then tried to gently tell him I needed to go. "It's inspection day, so we're really cramming right now," I added. "Call me this evening, hey? I'm sorry you're stuck on the road."
"Yeah, well, it stinks, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed that the part comes in today. I could drive all night and get back to Hatteras in time to still make it before sign-in. I need my board, though. I left it down at the house in Ocracook, so if you can catch a ferry down today, then bring it back, I'll pick it up at your place and be good to go. There's a key under the dead plant on the porch. I'll give you directions to the house. It's not hard to find."
"What? Ross, I can't go."
"And the dog's there, too. I didn't get a chance to take him over to Mom and Dad's before I left, and he's probably out of food by now. I left a bucket full, but he eats like a horse. There's extra in the garage."
His voice echoed into the room. Zoe snorted, sorting jewelry on the coffee table. I realized that everyone else was catching at least the gist of this. "Ross, I can't go down to Ocracook today." Balancing the phone on my shoulder, I squatted by the baseboard to pull off the painter's tape from last night. "It's a 40-minute ferry ride one way, and we're trying to get the shop ready for inspection today. I can't leave." Ross made a sound that was somewhere between a groan and a whimper.
Well, okay, all right. Zoe can go after school. Tell her that as soon as I get back, I'll give her $50 for doing it. She can get Romeo to ride along. They can take his car across with him.
Zoe can't go. She's had West Nile virus, remember? What world did Ross live in sometimes?
Zoe sneered at the phone. Of course he doesn't remember. Across the room, Sandy smacked her lips apart. Ross, I have to go.
But the dog needs food and water, Tandy, and I need my board.
All of a sudden, he sounded like a lost little boy. I can't take care of it. I'm sorry. You'll have to call Gumby or neighbor down on Ocracoke or somebody else to feed your dog, at least, okay?
Yeah, well, fine.
He said goodbye, and we hung up.
He's such a jerk.
Zoe was untangling one pearl necklace from another. I feel sorry for the dog. Sandy scooped up Chum and gave him a noogie while he snorted and tried to lick her.
I'd never like you in a yard and leave you without food while I went out of town.
She started toward the back door without saying anything more, but clearly Sandy didn't have a high opinion of Ross so far. I was glad when the morning passed and he didn't call again. Hopefully that meant he'd found someone to take care of the dog. Zoe fell asleep on the sofa before lunch. By then, Sharon and Teresa had shown up, and the four of us had the shop ready for inspection. I left Zoe on the sofa and went outside to join the shell shop girls at a table on the deck. Sandy had decreed that there wasn't one more thing we could possibly do to prepare, and so we should take a break for crab balls and coffee. The inspector wasn't due for 2 hours yet. I lost track of the chatter at lunch. I was thinking of Zoe and how monumentally sad she'd looked, sitting there sorting the jewelry, her movements robotic and disinterested. This fairy tale of an empty bedroom at Aunt Gina's was just one more blow, one more rejection when she was already hurting. I wanted to make everything better, but I didn't know how. A pile of driftwood in back of the workshop caught my eye as Teresa and her mother said goodbye, and Sharon got up to walk around front with them.
You're in another world, Sandy remarked.
Chum hopped onto one of the recently emptied chairs and sat down, his bug eyes shifting back and forth between Sandy and me as if he were looking for a chance to break into the conversation. I was just thinking about Zoe. She's having such a hard time getting over the breakup with Rowdy. She doesn't want to go back to school. Sandy reclined in her chair, watching two kids in kayaks pass by on the sound.
Well, she's young. Rejection is hard to deal with when you're young. Give her time. She'll be stronger for it in the long run.
Chum bounded into Sandy's lap and tried to kiss her, and she pushed his little snout away.
Stop that. I'll throw you to the sharks. You'll end up somewhere out to sea with my picture frame and the rest of my glass boxes.
An idea lit in my mind, sudden and alluring. Sandy, could I have a piece of that driftwood that's piled behind the shop? Leaning around me, she looked at the wood.
Well, sure, if you want it. We just threw it there after the storm to get it out of the way. What have you got in mind?
I want to make something for Zoe. Would you mind if I use the tools out in the workshop? I mean, if there's nothing else you need me to do inside right now, that is. I'm too nervous to sit and wait for the inspector to show up, but I don't want to go home either. I want to be here when he can't find one thing to complain about.
Sandy winked, then pointed a finger at me. I like your confidence, and of course you can use anything you need in the workshop. My place is your place.
Bracing her hand, she pushed to her feet, groaning.
I've got to go sweep the porch or something. I'm a wreck.
She patted my shoulder as she circled the table, then walked back into the store. Chum started after her, but decided to follow me instead. Together, we selected just the right piece of driftwood from the pile, one grayed and cracked from the salt water, twisted and knotted in a way that spoke of struggle and strength. Chum helped himself to an empty stool near the workbench, watching as I measured and planned. Sometime later, he fell asleep to the hum and whine of the bandsaw. All else seemed to fade away as I worked. I forgot about Zoe's problems and my own and the store inspection. There was only the bit of driftwood, slowly changing as I worked, slowly becoming something new. Its intended form was taking shape when Zoe's voice traveled in from the back deck.
Mama! Mama!
I hadn't heard that much emotion in her voice in so long. My heart sped up, and I wondered if something was wrong. I covered my driftwood creation just in time. Zoe burst through the door, and Chum met her, yipping and wagging. They skidded into each other on the sawdust and nearly toppled a plastic container filled with sheet glass.
Mama!
Zoe wheezed, catching her breath. Zoe, what's the matter?
Her eyes glittered, her cheeks flushing as her lips parted in a smile.
We passed. The inspection. The guy showed up early, and I walked around with him and Sandy, and I was coughing a little, and I told him I had West Nile, and he didn't stay here very long at all. I think he thought I was like Typhoid Mary, and we passed.
Chapter 21. A storm was slated to roll onto the island during the grand reopening day of the seashell shop. We watched the prediction on the news before finally locking the doors and leaving on Tuesday. The shop was cleaned and organized, fully stocked and waiting for the music festival customers to arrive. After working on inventory and sorting, polishing, and washing mud-covered pottery that had been stored in the shed after the last hurricane, the shop girls were exhausted. We'd been like sailors on a ship making ready for the wild waters around Cape Hatteras, Sandy at the helm issuing orders and the rest of us scurrying. Before we left, Sandy had rounded us up on the porch, all the seashell shop sisters, Sandy's husband, George, Greg and Crystal from the restaurant next door, Paul and JT, who'd come by after school, and Zoe, who made excuses not to go to school that day, complaining that she still didn't feel well. Watching her work at the shop, it was obvious that she wasn't really sick anymore. I was dreading forcing her to finally get on the bus with JT. It would be an ugly battle of wills. Spending time with her at Sandy's the past couple days had been nice, more relaxed. The shop girls fawned over her like a gaggle of grandmas, giving her and the West Nile virus credit for chasing away the inspector. Zoe laughed and talked and seemed more like her old self. It was good to see her happy. Sandy wanted us to pray for tomorrow's reopening, right there outside the shop, with the cars rushing by. Zoe glanced at me, probably thinking I'd find some way to make a run for the car before the prayer circle could form, but I didn't. After weeks of sharing Iola's prayers, journeying along as she offered up her hopes, her pain, her helplessness and confusion when life didn't happen according to plan, it seemed natural. I started to write notes of my own and tuck them into a rusty cracker tin I'd unearthed in Iola's pantry and taken back to the cottage. A prayer box for myself. My first. Someday, when I could afford it, I'd buy the lighthouse box from Sandy, the one that had survived the storm, and make things more official. Sandy had offered to give it to me, but I told her I'd rather pay for it. She'd agreed to put it in the storeroom until I was ready. For now, my notes were simple, a fledgling effort at conversation, but committing them to the cracker tin somehow helped me to let the thoughts go and stop spinning them round and round in my head. Thank you for Zoe's smile. Help me to help her. To show her how amazing she is. Thank you for Sandy and the sisterhood of the shell shop. Please protect Iola's house. Show me what I should do. Stop them from tearing it down. Help me to save it somehow. There must be a way. Send good weather. No more rain. There's so much plaster falling in. Sandy and the shell shop girls were praying for good weather, too. I felt the urgency of that prayer through our clasped hands. Zoe's on one side and JT's on the other, linking to Paul. Each of us knew the high stakes of the days ahead. Hatteras had pieced itself back together again, and if the music festival didn't bring in a crowd, it would be a blow to the local businesses, an indication that tourists had decided to stay farther north on the banks for now, rather than returning to Hatteras, where the streets were still dotted with ravaged houses and the remnants of storm damage. When the prayer was over, we left quietly, like parishioners exiting church. Even Chum walked soberly off the porch rather than doing his usual crazy dog figure eights. JT asked if he could go by the classroom with Paul to get some things ready for tomorrow's lab project, and I let him. I knew that when Paul dropped JT off later, he would probably sit in his truck a minute before he backed out, and I would probably go outside. We would linger and talk about the day or Zoe's issues or some funny question JT had come up with while he and Paul were out and about. The routine had become an unspoken thing that both of us looked forward to. Zoe and I drove home without saying much. I tried talking to her about going back to school tomorrow. She went into avoidance mode. Not tomorrow. It's opening day. A desperate look slanted my way, her bottom lip unconsciously pooching out in a pout, then trembling a little. I'm caught up and on my homework anyway. Paul had been helping by gathering Zoe's work and sending it home with JT. I caved. Okay, one more day, but Zoe, you're going to have to face this. You can't let other people decide your life for you. Who cares what Rowdy and his friends say about you or think about you? Other people's judgment doesn't have any power unless you offer yourself up for trial, so don't. Zoe blinked and looked at me like I had two heads. That last part didn't sound like anything that would have come from my mouth. It was a quote directly from one of Iola's letters, a bit of parting advice from Sister Marguerite. Something I was trying to remember. I'd been offering myself up for trial my whole life, determining myself by what my parents said about me, whether men wanted me, whether the wives in Trammell's circle accepted me. It had never even crossed my mind that I had a choice in the matter. Remember that you are God's, not theirs. Sister Marguerite's final words to Iola as she walked through the gates of the orphanage for the last time. I wrote it down that night and tucked it into my box. Please help Zoe to see that she isn't theirs. Thunder was rumbling outside when I closed the box and went to bed. I was tempted to sneak over to Iola's house to check the drip buckets, but that would only lure me into staying. I'd been keeping close to the cottage since Zoe's illness, just making sure the running away idea didn't resurface. With Ross still stuck out of town, it was easy to hang around home without it being obvious to Zoe. I hadn't given much thought to the fact that I wasn't really sorry Ross's mechanical problems had delayed him a few more days. I was afraid to analyze the reasons for that too deeply, but the question nagged as I closed my eyes and went to sleep, bone-weary but happy. Just before dawn, I woke to the sound of a bird singing outside the window. I lay awake, listening, looking into the misty morning haze, the beginnings of a perfect day. After all our hard work, I'd prayed that it would be. This day, the birds singing, the blushing sky, felt like an answer. In committing these prayers to you, I have come to see the answers in everything. Words from Iola's letters, now tucked in the closets of my mind. By asking the questions, I'd begun to see answers in the simple things that happened each day, like a pile of driftwood left stacked behind a building. Zoe's birthday was coming up. I hadn't even thought of that when I'd started the box for her. I took a blanket and a cup of coffee and went out on the porch, watching as fingers in morning sunlight stretched through the loblolly pines and touched the wet grass, outlining each strand in a silver hue. Just out of sight, beyond the salt meadow and the trees, the marina came to life as fishermen rigged their nets and crews made ready for the day. Metal rang against metal. Motors rumbled, tires grated against gravel. On the road, Geneva Bink passed by in her golf cart. She waved at me as if we were old friends, and I waved back with my coffee mug. Closing my eyes, I rested my head on my knees, lulled by the music of early morning. Was it possible for life to really be this good, this peaceful? For everything to be so beautiful all at once? Thank you. Everything in my soul was whispering it. I guess our big prayer worked. I opened my eyes, and JT was standing in the doorway, blinking drowsily under a bad case of bedhead. Guess it did. It's a perfect morning. I purposely didn't look toward Iola's house. I didn't want to be reminded of the problems with it, not today. Instead, I stood, fanned out my blanket, and folded JT in for a hug. Then we walked backward through the door like a pair of clumsy dancers. We'd better get ready, huh? Paul said if you wanted to come to the seashell shop with me this morning, he would pick you up there and give you a ride to school. Oh, man, JT complained, and I was surprised. Usually he wanted to go anywhere with Paul. Why can't I stay home from school like Zoe? Don't remind me. Oh, no, somebody as smart as you shouldn't miss school ever. JT skewed his brows, one up and one down, tipping his head back against the circle of the blanket to look at me.
Does that mean I'm smarter than Zoe because she's skipping?
That means you're not skipping school. I tweaked the end of his nose. He was such a great kid. How could I have ever left him to shift for himself for hours and days on end? His best friends, the characters on some video game. And Zoe's only getting off one more day, and that's only because Sandy might need her. We have to make sure the shop has a smooth opening day. In the bedroom, Zoe was moving around. The bed squeaked as she rolled over, probably flopping onto her stomach and covering her head with the pillow to shut out our noise.
So if Sandy needs me when we get there this morning, can I ditch school? We used to ditch all the...
JT gathered the answer from my expression.
Sheesh, okay.
Sheesh. He'd gotten that from Paul. I ruffled his hair with the blanket, and it stood on end, clinging to the fabric. Go get ready. Let's see if we can beat everyone else to the seashell shop. But by the time we finally dragged Zoe out of bed and made it to the shop,
Sandy was already there, bustling around the interior, checking and double-checking and triple, quadruple, quintuple-checking everything. The rest of us filed in one by one, and when Paul stopped by to pick up JT, everything in the store was practically glistening. Every candle, seagull statue, bit of shell art, and piece